This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe David Johnson. He's a senior research scientist and molecular biologist at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at New Mexico State University, Las Cruces. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you study soil, and we've talked on this program a lot about soil in different ways. This is International Year of the Soil.
Yes.
And who declared that? Is that the United Nations?
The United Nations did,
yeah.
Yes.
And so one of the things you talk about is peak soil, like peak oil. What does that mean?
The rate of loss of our soil far outweighs the rate of a replacement. In the U.S., it's about 10 metric tons per hectare per year loss.
That's a lot.
Especially when our replenishment rate is only from a half to 1 metric ton.
Oh, my goodness.
And India and China are much worse than us.
So why are we losing so much topsoil?
Our management techniques in agriculture, both farmland and rangeland. We're not working with nature to keep the soils covered with plants, and therefore we're losing soils through wind erosion, water erosion, and the remaining land we have, we're working on losing that from either salination, be it the soil's becoming too salty.
How does it get salty?
A lot of the fertilizers we apply, they're applied as a salt. And so the mineral nutrient breaks away from the salt, the plant takes it up and leaves the salt component. So that creates a situation where you just keep building up in salts. And if it's irrigated land, you do leach those down, but then eventually they will fill the water table and you'll be pumping them back up and deposit them again on your soil.
And meanwhile, you're making the waters, the underground aquifers, salty.
You're destroying your water supplies also.
There's other things, too, like building on land.
Yes, we're losing it through subdivision development also. And also other chemical pollution. A lot of the fertilizers that we mine, the phosphates, they also have heavy metals in them. And those become a residue in the soil and start to poison the soil, and the plants are unable to grow in them.
We're not doing a very good job. Topsoil is incredibly important. I mean, it is the source of our food.
Yes, and many civilizations have gone down because of this.
So we're losing topsoil at a rapid rate. In nature, topsoil forms much more slowly, and there's kind of a general public understanding that it takes centuries for topsoil to form. But one of the things that I've been learning is that if you try to create topsoil intentionally and build soil, you can actually do it more quickly.
Yes, yes. If you promote the microbial community development, they are the ones that are actually building up your topsoil. They function in every biogeochemical process on Earth. They are mediators of every cycle of nutrients on this planet. So if you work to build up the microbial population, you can start to increase the rate of soil formation. In some cases, they've seen when they adopt these management practices to build the biology up, they see the topsoil start to build up and start to cover rocks and fields that were there before where the soil had eroded away.
So it's the opposite of erosion. You can actually build it back.
Yes.
Now, microbes are incredibly important, and one of the things that's so interesting is that the microbes in the soil, in a lot of ways, are analogous to the microbes in our own bodies.
Totally.
Tell us about that.
Well, we very much depend on our microbial community. We're outnumbered 10 to 1 cell count, number of microbial cells to the cells in our body. In our genetic makeup, the genes that we have, we only have about 30,000 genes. Our microbial complement has 8 million. So we are very little human and mostly microbial.
And that's something that isn't that well understood, particularly in a society that is so kind of focused on an antibacterial bacterial ideology. It's almost like we think that microbes are all pathogenic, they're all dangerous, they're all going to kill us, when it's the opposite.
We very much depend on them too. The immune system that we have is developed through the microbes we have. About two-thirds of our immune system is in our stomach. So that perception grew out of when we first had trouble with polio and smallpox and all the other diseases that were singled out. But a lot of this has begun because of some of the lifestyle choices that we've made that have created situations where the microbes in our personal microbial communities are compromised. And when that happens, these other organisms sneak in. They fill that niche that's been vacated. Like I was talking about it, Crohn's disease, where we've taken these regimens of antibiotics to cure some kind of disease, and yet they will wipe out the community structure of your stomach and intestinal microflora. And then another organism comes in, like Clostridium difficile, and it populates that area because it's a niche that needs to be filled. And then you have all the problems from that in your Crohn's disease. People suffer for years with this, and they give them more antibiotics. They can cut out sections of their intestine, all kinds of treatment methodologies that are pretty archaic in this respect.
Except the one obvious one, which is repopulating the healthy bacteria.
Correct. And that's where they've done the fecal transplants into the intestines of these people that are afflicted by Crohn's. And they've had very good success in remission, 80% in some studies, 100% in others. And in some cases, they've had a change in 24 hours, that these people were debilitated 24 hours previous, but yet have a healthy, functional intestinal flora after 24 hours, after inoculation.
That says a lot about resilience.
Yes. It also tells us a lot about what we're able to do if we restore microbial community structures.
Yeah. So let's go back to soil, microbial community structures, and I keep thinking of these communities as like little communities of people who have jobs. And
exactly.
As a scientist, do you see it that way?
I see it totally. We are just an analogy of, our system is an analogy of what you see in microbes. They're just like us. They depend on energy for them to function. If they don't have energy, they're basically cavemen. Very few population and very much a struggle in life to survive. As you increase the energy supply in this system, and in both cases, it's carbon. In our cases, the carbon is fossil fuels. That's what makes our lifestyles very convenient. It makes us be able to have economies where we can progress. You add a little more energy to the system, you start to have population increases. A little more, you start to have specializations. A little more, mutualisms. And eventually you get to synergies, like what you see in the big cities. So I see it very much the same in either your intestinal microbial community or soil microbial communities.
Or urban communities made of humans. So let's take that analogy to soil. So you've got plants growing, you've got these microbial communities down under the soil, in the soil, and they're really specialized. They do different things.
Yes.
What do they do?
Well, nitrogen is a very important element in our body and in every living organism. In fact, we are more a nitrogen-oriented organism than we are carbon. Carbon is good as for structures and storage of energy, but the reactive molecules in our body are all nitrogen-based. Every protein is made from a chain of amino acids. All those amino acids have nitrogen in them. When you put them all together, you have a protein that has a specific function. We'll take nitrogen fixation. There's a protein called nitrogenase that can break that nitrogen triple-triple bond. It's one of the strongest bonds known in nature. And it can do it at room temperature and standard pressure. For us to do it in an industry situation, it's 500 degrees C and from 22 to 3,600 pounds per square inch. So they can do things at room temperature and standard pressure that we can't even contemplate doing in industry.
Now, these are microbes in our body, microbes in the soil?
Microbes in the soil.
Yeah.
So that's one instance of the things they do. And that nitrogen, again, is the basis of everything on this planet.
So in some ways, when we look at industrial agriculture, we've tried to do what nature does through artificial means instead of letting nature do it itself. Is that right?
Correct.
So what does that look like?
Well, we've made assumptions that, okay, all they need are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to grow the plants. And so we've substituted those in. And what we haven't realized is that, well, carbon is involved in this, and micronutrients are involved in this. And in the past, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium we put into the soil, at the same time we're using those, they're drawing micronutrients out of the soil.
What are micronutrients?
Micronutrients be calcium, copper, iron, zinc. All these are metal cofactors in a protein that make these protein structures work, like magnesium is used for photosynthesis. It's a cofactor in a protein. It's very functional in capturing that energy from the sun and changing that energy and water to and CO2 to a sugar.
And so when we put those fertilizers on from the outside that don't contain all those micronutrients, then what do plants do with them and what happens to the microbes?
Well, what happens is two things. First of all, we affect the microbial community structure. We affect the portion of that microbial community structure that is functional for extracting those micronutrients, which would be the mycorrhizal fungi. They're one of the organisms in the soil that help mine these micronutrients for plants. When they're gone, you don't have any replenishment of the micronutrients, so you start to deplete them. And when you deplete them, there are certain processes that can't go on in a plant unless those micronutrients are available. So we shortcut the system when we think we're doing better by adding nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium.
I can't help but think that those micronutrients are things that we spend a lot of money on in health food stores buy them and eat them separately because we're not getting them from our food.
Yes. I see that as a potential that we are depleting some of the micronutrients in our food supplies. And I think there's some studies that have demonstrated this when they did analysis on some of the fruits and vegetables.
That they just contain fewer minerals.
Yes.
Meanwhile, those minerals are sitting there in the soil, unavailable to the plant.
In the soil, parent material, they're there.
Yeah.
And they're in sufficient quantities. It's just they have to be extracted and available to the plant to be able to be used.
Which can't be done without all these little critters
running around. Every factory worker has to be there.
Yeah.
And if you miss the person, the factory line stops.
You've taken pictures of these little critters under the microscope. They're quite amazing. Some of them are very tiny. Some of them look like little worms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Describe them.
Well, you have your bacteria. They're at the base of the system. And you have your fungi. The next trophic level up would be the protozoa. And I'll use that term because it's rather loose now, where most of these are unknown as far as classification. We haven't been able to really give them a good name because they start to cross, they blur the lines between microbes and plants because they can do both functions.
They photosynthesize?
Some of them can photosynthesize. They're mobile, like animals. Some of them have life cycles that stretch. Well, part of their life cycle is mobile, like some of the fungi. And then when they come into a stationary phase, they come into just a hyphal structure. From a zoospore, which is a moving organism, to a hyphae.
What's a hyphae?
It's the little threads of fungi that you will see in a soil or when you look under the microscope.
Oh, yeah, those little threads. So these are all the little people underground who make our food nutritious, that help it grow, that build soil, and that we regularly destroy by using pesticides and fertilizers and all those things. So are we getting to a crisis point? Like if we're losing that much soil and we're not rebuilding it, like what happens? I mean, we haven't hit massive famine here in the United States, at least not yet, but it seems like this can't go on forever.
As I said, it was the elephant in the room that we're ignoring. you're right, we can't go on like this. And we have to realize on the time scales we use things, energy, water, our soils, they're a finite resource. They don't replenish faster than what we're exhausting them. Same with energy. We're making energy every day. Photosynthesis is going on. There's a certain amount of storage of carbon, but we're not replenishing it at the rate that we're using it. And so we see this also in water. So all of these work together to create a system that's in jeopardy, in my estimation. But it can be fixed.
So let's talk about that. How can it be fixed?
Well, restoration, like we saw in Crohn's disease in the human organism, if you restore that community, function returns. I'm seeing the same thing in soils, that if you restore the microbial community structure and its function, and you change your management technique to support microbial development, you turn this around. It's a whole different game. You start to build your soils back up. You start to increase carbon. You start to hold on to water. And a lot of this is velocity of the carbon and water through this system. We're slowing that velocity down. Right now, water goes right through a soil because it doesn't have enough carbon in it to store it. The same thing with carbon. We're burning it up faster than we're replacing it. But slowing the velocity of water and carbon down in the system will start building the microbial communities, which will start building the soil carbon, which will return the fertility to our soils.
When you talked about Crohn's disease, it's almost unbelievable how quickly that can turn around when these bacterial microbial colonies are replaced in a person's digestive system. What about in soil? I mean, this is not an overnight turnaround.
No, we've done a lot of damage, and we've taken the carbon in our bank. We've exhausted our bank account as far as carbon. But you can turn this around. I've seen in my transitional soils averaged just a little less than 0.25% carbon increase per year, or about a little over 10 tons carbon per hectare per year.
Isn't that the same number that you said we were losing?
Oh, we're talking carbon. Soil and carbon are going to be just a little different.
Okay.
But yes, that's about the same range.
One of the factors in all of this is, it's not that we're exactly running out of energy, but the return on investment in the energy that we produce is a lot less than it used to be. So it used to be that fossil fuels were readily available and relatively cheap. We've exhausted sort of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak.
Exactly.
And now it's getting harder and harder and more expensive. What does that mean for agriculture?
Well, agriculture is very dependent on fossil fuels right now. In the 40s, we used to get, for every calorie of fossil fuels we would put into the system, we would get 2.6 calories back. Now, for every calorie we put into the system, we only get a tenth of a calorie back. So we really completely changed it from productive to unproductive.
Right. And so we've got what seems like a daunting task before us, but we also have this thing, which is that nature already knows how to do it for free with solar energy.
Yes. She's been doing it for 3.8 billion years we've had photosynthesis.
Yeah.
That's when they started pumping oxygen into the atmosphere.
Now, you are at NMSU, New Mexico State University, and you've done some really interesting experiments, basically, about improving agricultural soils without chemicals. Biologically Enhanced Agricultural Management, BEAM is the acronym.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, looking at the soils, as I said, we need to improve the soil microbial community. So that's the biological enhancement part. But you also have to bring that management component in. We just can't go out there and throw microbes on the soil and expect them to rescue that piece of land. It's a management technique where my wife says it the best. It's like that fifth animal on the farm where you have to take care of it. You have to make sure it has enough water, enough air, and feed it. And it's the same thing with your soil. Your soil is supporting everything else on the farm, but it's that realization that it is a living organism. And we just can't treat it like a sponge. If we treat it like a living organism, it can work with us. And all the decisions are made for you. This is the nice thing about it. It makes farming much more practical and much more enjoyable. Just like if you're using it in your, at home in your garden, it makes gardening fun again.
So what does that look like? Let's say you're doing that at home in your garden.
Well, you need to start backing off on your synthetic fertilizer use, realizing that it is a living organism that you're depending on to feed you. And you need to start building your soil up. I think composting of the waste products that we have is the best way. It seems like you get the best diversity in an inocula that you put on the soils by doing with it with composting.
So you basically compost, you put your compost on the soil, you plant stuff, and you sit back. You water it.
Yes, you do maintain it. You also want to realize that you have to have, this is an energy equation. To get the energy into the soil, you have to be growing a plant. So you have to realize, okay, I have to grow a plant year-round. And in the winter, you would put in a winter cover crop. And it would be a mixture of plants. I put in vetches, peas, bell beans, you know, legumes mostly, and then usually an oat in there for structure for everything to climb on. And you're spending the whole winter, you're capturing carbon, you're capturing nitrogen, you're starting to put, the plant puts exudates into the soil to start feeding these microbial communities. So when in the spring, I usually just cut it down, dry it, chip it, and then I use it as a mulch on the garden, and that feeds my garden all summer. And it keeps the weeds down. You have to water less. It's just a more elegant system and an easier system when all the decisions for what that plant needs are made by the plant and the organism that it depends on, the microorganisms.
Who knew that there was so much stuff going on in soil in the winter?
Well, we had no clue. And we've just gotten the technology that enables us to look at those communities and be able to see who's there and what they're doing.
Now, is this true in, like, North Dakota or places that get really, really cold?
Everywhere.
So even when the ground is frozen solid, it's still active?
Microbes are still busy.
Really?
They're
very
slower.
Interesting, yeah.
But this never stops.
So how do you bring this information out of the university and into the rest of the world?
Well, that's what I'm trying to do now. Looking at venues like Kavira and their conference that they put on, I'm trying to work with the state of New Mexico, the environmental department here, to start getting farmers paid for this so they can implement this on their farms. The transition is tough for a farmer. It's tough enough out there to make a profit at farming, and there's good years, there's bad years, a good year, and then the price goes down. There's all kinds of things they have to fight, but if we can help them through the transition to start restoring their soils and backing off from the chemical use and start putting carbon back in the soil, all this works to the betterment of them.
Do you get pushback from the people who are trying to sell farmers chemicals?
You know, I avoid most of that. I'm working a different approach. I don't want to confront conventional ag. I'm more, well, let's tackle this problem a different way. If we can capture carbon and build up soil fertility at the same time, that's the avenue I want to take. I'm looking for that positive. I don't want to degrade anybody else's opinion or approach or business on this. It's tough enough to get it in a positive light and to get it through to people.
But in theory and eventually in practice, they will be able to stop spending quite so much money on all those inputs.
Yes.
Have you worked with farmers who have made that transition?
Yes, we're working with four farmers in the Mesilla Valley that are starting into this, just the first foray. And it's funny, after the first year, all they're talking is soil biology. Maybe we're hearing it from the farmers. You won't believe this. Which, the farmers are so key to this.
Yeah.
We need their input. We need to know what are they observing and to know to make this transition better for others. We don't know everything on this transition. This is something relatively new, and we've just got a pretty good understanding now of what's going on. So we're learning along with the farmers.
A piece of this that's also incredibly important is that when you stop using chemicals on the soil, it is able to hold carbon and hold some of it permanently. So it is a vehicle for carbon sequestration, which, you know, it's like if you Google carbon sequestration, you get all this like high tech stuff and, you know, injecting gas into the sea and things like that. But you don't necessarily get like photosynthesis.
I don't know why it's being disregarded. It's
yeah.
It's the most, the Rubisco protein, which is the one that fixes this carbon into the sugars, it's the most prevalent protein on the surface of the earth. And yet we're ignoring its capability and the capability of photosynthesis to augment the situation.
Yeah.
You know, to solve the problem here.
I just keep thinking it's free, you know?
It is. The energy is free on this. We don't have to, I mean, besides for a little bit of plowing, a little bit of disking, excuse me, and planting and some irrigation. It can actually be done relatively free on rangeland, too. So, yes, it's a low-cost system that's very elegant, and it solves the problem and other problems.
What are some of the other problems it solves?
Well, if we're not putting the fertilizers on there, we're not getting them being leached into the waterways. Nitrogen and phosphorus both get leached into waterways. They end up either in our lakes or streams or aquifers or in the ocean or in estuaries. All kinds of problems in there. Or the nitrogen, very little nitrogen actually is getting to the plant. The majority is either put into the atmosphere by microbes breaking down the nitrogen we put in, or it's going into the water streams and down.
What are the economic benefits in a place like New Mexico of farming this way to the farmer?
In the short run or the long run?
You tell me.
Well, it's tough in the transition. Eventually, once they build their soils up, they'll see they'll be able to make a better profit, grow more crop on less land. Short term is tougher. That's why I'm trying to get them subsidized, basically, to be paid for the carbon that they are capturing, to get them through this transition. And it's only a short transition, you know, 5 to 10 years. I think at that point, a farmer's going to see, this is in my best interest to do. And then he'll start doing it on his own, because he'll see that it's more productive, less decisions, and an easier life for him, more profitable.
What are your hopes for agriculture in the state of New Mexico when you look at the big picture? What do you think it could look like? I mean, we sometimes wring our hands about things like alfalfa and pecans and crops that take so much water.
It's an issue.
Yeah.
If you increase the soil carbon in a desert sandy soil 1%, you quintuple the amount of water that you can hold in that soil. That's just 1%. If we're doing this in all of our farms, we can avoid some of the problems that we see in drought, because they're able to hold that water longer and use it more efficiently. You also see a change in, you can start to reduce soil salinity once you build these microbes up. So that's going to restore a lot of these soils that we're having problems with, because that is a big problem in the Mesilla Valley. A lot of our soils are becoming saline because of the irrigation water, the application of synthetic fertilizers, the reapplication once you irrigate again from the salts. So as you build this soil up, you build up the fungal community, it can start to reduce the sodium content in that soil. As I saw it in the composting process that we developed, you know, as it was an issue to use dairy waste or horse manure too, both of them very saline, and yet when you run it through this compost process, you're actually tying up a lot of the sodium salts into insoluble oxalates, is what we believe is happening.
And ladies and gentlemen in radio land, lest you be put off by terms like oxalates and things like, we don't know what they are, I don't know what they are, but the big picture is, at least as I understand you, the more you work with the processes of nature, the better things will work out in the long run.
Yes, and to help you on the oxalate thing, fungi secrete oxalic acid. It is two CO2 molecules back to back. And that is a very strong acid, and they use it to break down either organic matter or they use it to break down the soil parent material, the rocks. They can actually drill through a rock to get the elements out of that rock that the plant needs. This is a whole nother potential mechanism for carbon sequestration, that oxalic acid will, as I said, pair with like a sodium or a magnesium ion, and that's an insoluble salt. But then oxalotrophic bacteria, those that love these oxalates, will go in there and they will use some of the energy in the bonds of that oxalate. They'll grab a calcium, add it to a carbonate, and that will give you an inorganic carbon form that will stay in the soil for a very long time. And also, it will leach down through the soil profile, and in some cases, it will form a... That's what we see in the desert, is a caliche. That's the carbonates that have leached down through the periodic rains and pulled those calcium carbonate entities that have been made through this oxalotrophic bacteria process.
So a state like New Mexico that does have a lot of agricultural land, does have a lot of sun, and it's a big state, what do you envision could be our contribution in this world, in this country, toward climate change mitigation through soil?
I believe we could be a good example of how to solve this problem. New Mexico Environmental Department is very interested in this process. NRCS, the people that work in Natural Resource Conservation Services, are very oriented towards soil biology, soil fertility. And it's the synergy between them and the state. Hopefully, the electric companies will be able to get in on this because they have an obligation to reduce their CO2 emissions. And if we can work with the power companies and the state and the environmental department, we can satisfy the requirements that New Mexico will have to have for CO2 reduction from these power plants, because the state is liable to reduce these CO2 emissions. And the power plants, likewise, have an obligation to enable it, because their power plant is on the line if they can't reduce their CO2 emissions.
Very interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. David Johnson is a senior research scientist and molecular biologist at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.